640 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. With the June 5th default deadline, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer urges quick passage of the debt ceiling bill.
We will keep working until the job is done.
But as CBS's Natalie Brand reports,
some conservative Republicans and progressive Democrats in the Senate oppose the bill.
There's no way I can pass this much debt onto my grandchildren.
Among the senators coming out against it are South Carolina's Tim Scott, who's running for president, and Vermont's Bernie Sanders.
The American people, in my view, are sick and tired of seeing deficit reduction come on the backs of working people who are struggling.
Three residents of a Davenport, Iowa apartment building that partially collapsed Sunday are still unaccounted for. CBS's Jim Grisula.
Two of the five people originally reported as missing have been located. Mayor Mike Mattson is defending the city's building inspection process.
We have a pretty rigorous inspection process now, and we've upped that numerous times in the last few years. Believe me, we will look at this again.
The city of Davenport has released documents, including structural engineering reports, that show the building's owner was told that patches of brick facade were separating from the building, and the building was at risk. Jim Crisulda, CBS News.
After unusually hot weather in portions of New England today, CBS News meteorologist David Parkinson says stifling heat hits other areas tomorrow.
At least two dozen records falling from Kentucky up to Vermont. We'll be seeing record high temperatures in the Philadelphia metropolitan area, as high as 95 degrees in Reading, 92 degrees just outside of Washington, D.C., and 92 degrees in Hartford, Connecticut.
Disgraced comedian Bill Cosby is hit with another sexual assault lawsuit.
Now, 80-year-old former Playboy model Victoria Valentino says Cosby drugged and raped her more than five decades ago. She says he was comforting her after her six-year-old son died. She spoke with the Washington Post in 2014.
It's very difficult for me to talk about what he did. You know, Anyway,
Valentino is suing Cosby under a new California law that temporarily lifts the statute of limitations for civil sexual assault cases. A Cosby spokesman says there are inconsistencies in Valentino's claims. Christopher Cruz, CBS News.
A preliminary court date. A hearing is set for August 31st for Andrew Lester, the 84-year-old white man accused of shooting black teenager Ralph Yarl. The teen went to the wrong house in April to pick up his siblings. The judge has agreed to seal the documents in the case. Yarl family attorney Ben Crump criticizes that decision.
He committed no other offense, no other crime, no threat. He rang the doorbell.
Andrew Lester has pleaded not guilty to first-degree assault and armed criminal action. This is CBS News.
Hiring's a lot easier with Indeed. Their powerful platform makes it easy to attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
You're listening to a radio station that's part of the Civic Media Network. Find more at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Natnair. Here's what you need to know. The teenager who was arrested in April carrying a gun outside of Waukesha North High School made his first court appearance this week. Now 18-year-old Ashel Ali, charged with second-degree recklessly endangering safety, bail-jumping felony, resisting an officer, and endangering safety by use of a dangerous weapon. At the time of his arrest, police say Ali was carrying a semi-automatic rifle with 30-round capacity magazine. He had a pillowcase over his head with the eyes cut out. The investigation continues after a car-van crash on a highway near Richland in Barron County earlier this week. A van carrying 10 people was struck by a car carrying four teenagers. Two people were killed. Three others were flown from the scene in critical condition. I'm Jane Natnair. This is Civic Media News.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
Folks, I tell you this much, the Cripes Cast is just the butter on my cheese.
Cockroaches, not that bad. They call them palmetto bugs in South Carolina. Same thing, you can call them up here.
Are they really palmetto bugs? Yes.
Yeah, and they're a great source of protein. They're going to be the lobsters of the future.
They also got salmonella, and they can lay like 40 eggs at once.
Well, they gotta work out a few kinks there, okay? They gotta work out a few kinks.
Cripes Cast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out, because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear, call me Papa Bear, because I'm grilling up dinner. Do you get it?
Yes, good job.
So, what should I do with all these coals?
Don't just toss them out. Put them in a metal container, because those embers can start a wildfire.
I understand. The stakes are high.
Ha, 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 ha.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Moving Day, a walk for Parkinson's, is happening around the country. Together we can unite in the fight against Parkinson's disease in a safe but exciting and fun way. So let's get moving. Join the Parkinson's Foundation to learn more and register at movingdaywalk.org.
Do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at therickSmithShow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here in Flint, Michigan, the farmers market, and what an incredible place this is. And as I said earlier, I love farmers markets. You know, growing up as a kid in Cleveland, we used to go to the West Side Market all the time downtown, and man, just brings back, you know, great memories of all the variety of things that I should not be touching, but good stuff all around. And they've done a fabulous job here. You have to give the good folks credit here at the work that they've done. But our goal here, talk to the folks in Flint, talk to people who are going to hopefully represent them one day. That's why I've asked Jasper Martis to come talk with us. Jasper is a candidate for the new 69th House District here in the Flint area. And I got to tell you, as I went and I looked at his website, hit the right notes for me. The first thing I saw was priority on jobs, priority on education, priority on infrastructure. Just what we've been saying, rebuilding our country, providing jobs for people, and educating folks. And this the way forward. That's why I've asked Jasper Martis to come sit down with us. Jasper, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I got to give you credit. Yeah, you're a young guy. This focus right on the issues. Mm-hmm. Explain to me how'd you get into this? Why'd you get into this?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah, so I always had a interest in politics. That was what I wanted to pursue with my career. Never really envisioned running at this point in my life, but this time last year with redistricting, the lines were redrawn, and I went to some of my mentors and asked, would this be possible, and would they help me out? And I worked on campaigns where it was for sure from day one that we were going to win, and for sure from day one we were going to lose, and most in between, and I was only going to do it if it was somewhere in the middle. During the primary, I knocked doors 152 days straight. I walked 1,005 miles, the equivalent of from Detroit, Michigan to Tallahassee, Florida. I lost 20 pounds, two pairs of shoes, and a relationship. Don't worry, she didn't revoke the donation. We really needed that towards the end there. And it was a real honor to run to represent a community that my family has called home for over a century. And we're still doing the work. We're still working to make sure that we win in November and elect folks who have priorities that align with what our working class needs here in Genesee County up and down the ballot. And just took some time off from some doors to talk to you today. And after that, probably going to grab some lunch and head back out on doors again.
Yeah, go back there, you know, talking to people, mm-hmm. you know, shaking hands, kissing babies, doing all of that stuff. Yeah. But, you know, we're in this moment mm-hmm. where, you know, when we talk to people and you're knocking on the doors, mm-hmm. what are the issues that you're getting from people? Because we're told we're divided. We're told yep. that we're too divided. We can't possibly come together. And mm-hmm. one of the things that I talk about all the time is we've got to figure out what the center of the road is. Mm-hmm. We got to get back between the curbs again, so mm-hmm. to speak. Mm-hmm. And as I started at the beginning, you know, education, jobs, mm-hmm. infrastructure, that is a good place to start mm-hmm. in my view.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it as well, figuring out where we can really agree. So I started knocking doors for my primary March 4th all the way through the election on August 2nd, and I've been getting back out there starting in September for the general. And you saw issues pop up based on what was going on in the news, whether it was abortion rights, gun control. I had to spend a few weeks early on explaining to folks I couldn't really do anything about the Ukraine situation. So you saw in real time what was covered on the news really being what people cared about. But at a deeper level, when you look past the headlines, when you look past what is dominating the news cycle, what really motivated me to run is I'm at an age now where there's a lot of folks who are a little bit older than me, a little bit younger than me. They graduate from high school or college or trade school, and they move somewhere else. They go to another part of the state, another part of the country, maybe even another country. And when I'm knocking on doors, it's the same experience I have at the grocery store. I don't run into those folks that I grew up with. I run into their parents and their grandparents and try to figure out how we can reverse that trend. And what I told everyone on doors when they would bring up creating good paying jobs here in Michigan and in Genesee County and investing in our infrastructure is we can't do it overnight. Not one single elected official on their own, not the best elected official in the world, can do that on their own overnight. It takes changing the narrative and working together with folks that have those common views to get things done for our community. And what Flint has gone through and the Genesee County area has gone through is like a lot of other states in the Midwest, that we've been not just under-resourced but undervalued and disrespected, and it's important that we have folks that stand up for the right issues.
No, absolutely. And you're listening to The Rick Smith Show with Jasper Martis. JasperMartis.com, the website. We'll get links out on social media. You can check out the website and the issues that are important to Jasper and the campaign that he's running. Now, you brought up an interesting thing that people are leaving. You know, one of the points of our tour, and one of the reasons we chose Flint is Flint has a very proud, prosperous past. A working class of prosperity that Leave It to Beaver era that clearly you do not remember and were not part of. But there's still that pride of that era. Do you see that coming back? Do you see this? Because nationally, Flint is known as a place with a lot of problems. But I look around, and this is it's a nice place. There are proud people, good, decent people that I've met. And What kind of message do you send to the rest of the country when people go, oh, Flint's got all these problems. Yeah. It's one of the poorest places in the country. What makes you stay? What's your vision for the future? Yeah. Or is that too broad?
Yeah, I think not believing the headlines. You know, you referenced growing up in Cleveland. Is that right?
Yep.
And I would say it's no longer the mistake on the lake, right? Or that was the nickname that they called it, right?
They still do, but you're right. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and in the communities like Flint, especially when we were going through the water crisis, we took a family trip to Washington, D.C. to see the monuments when the water crisis was going on. And when people said, people asked where we were from, and we said the Flint area, you would have thought we were talking about a war zone. And Flint is just like any other community where you have some rough areas, you have places where we need to be doing better. But look at downtown Flint. We're in this amazing Flint farmers market. If you go downtown, there's wonderful restaurants, wonderful things to do, and we really are seeing a comeback. We're seeing that in other places across Michigan, especially Detroit is doing it in its own way. So we went through years and years and years of folks moving away, and we're still, if you look at the census numbers, suffering from that. But when you look at what we're doing here downtown Flint, whether it's the farmers market, the restaurants, the things to do, we're trying to reverse that trend in our own way. And what I think it comes down to when you talked about how can we reverse that trend how can we get people to stay, it's trying to, we can never go back to the Andy Griffith Show and Leave It to Beaver and how things looked back then, and really kind of looking back and with rose-tinted glasses. Not every aspect of that is perfect, but trying to update that vision for where we are today. We have more technology. We have more social progress, certainly, than we did 50, 60 years ago. And so trying to recapture that vision of people being able to have decent work, having the dignity of work respected, having economic security, having educational opportunities, and whatever path you want to pursue, whether it's going through the trades, whether it's going to college, making sure that you have that opportunity here in Genesee County. And that I think is in our own way how we can kind of recapture some of that nostalgia we have when things were a lot easier and we had a lot more job opportunities.
No, absolutely. I'm arguing in this moment that we're at a crossroads moment. Mm-hmm. I think all elections somewhat are, but I think, you know, now more stark than ever. Mm-hmm. Because we've got an administration in Washington that is doing some things that I think are really important. We're investing heavily in infrastructure, investing in reshoring manufacturing. Mm-hmm. Maybe we bring some of those jobs back. Mm-hmm. You're never going to have GM be the powerhouse it was here in the past. But maybe we keep the manufacturing in the future, and maybe we turn those jobs into good, solid wage union jobs that are able to bring some aspects of Mayberry and some aspects of Leave it to Beaver back. So for me, the secret sauce is, you know, strong manufacturing, invest in infrastructure, and strengthening unions and promoting unions again. This used to be a very strong and still is a very strong union area. But to me, that's the secret sauce going forward.
Yeah. And when you especially look at Michigan's rich history of the union movement, the fight for workers' rights. I mean, we're in the home of the sit-down strike. It's funny, as a kid, I learned about the sit-down strike because my dad always showed me the Three Stooges when I was younger, and there's an episode where they actually kind of parody the in a positive way, talking about the sit-down strike, and I thought that was so amazing that the Three Stooges, the show that I loved to watch as a kid, that they would be in any way referencing the community that I'm from. I found that fascinating. And when you look at Michigan's robust history, it's quite frankly a disgrace that we're a right-to-work state. And I think we could see that change soon because with one of my big focuses now is not just electing myself in November. As you can imagine, I'm pretty biased towards doing that, but also flipping our state house, flipping our state senate, and reelecting Governor Gretchen Whitmer. We have the opportunity, the numbers are there, it's just a question of if people turn out, to flip the state house and senate and give our Democratic governor a Democratic state legislature for the first time since 1984. Priority number one for myself and many of my future colleagues will be repealing right to work, instituting prevailing wage across the board, and really shifting the conversation back to how can we rebuild Michigan. Governor Whitmer has made a lot of progress in her 4 years, but she has not had as many friends in the legislature as she needs, and that's been the same for previous administrations as well. So I think we are at a turning point, and at least here in Michigan, this is a make-or-break moment for revitalizing the union movement here in Michigan.
And the labor movement as a whole. And I'm glad to hear you say that, Jasper, because, you know, the reality is we saw in Virginia, they were able to flip their General Assembly and have the ability to repeal their No Rights at Work bill and didn't. And, you know, one of the things that's frustrating to me is, you know, Democrats have kind of let that part of the Democratic Party kind of go and not talk about labor, not talk about protecting workers' rights. So I'm happy to hear you're talking about it, that this is one of your priorities and that there are others in this state, because that would be, you know, I'm waiting for that tide change.
Yeah.
And maybe that could be the beginning of it. Scott Walker back in 2011 was kind of a tide change in moving towards attacking workers. Maybe Michigan can be the way back to the other direction.
I agree. And I think as well, when you talk about, we should really be proud of the broad coalition that the Democratic Party is. We have a lot of interests, a lot of stakeholders, a lot of folks that are fighting for good things. But what goes back generations and generations with the Democratic Party is fighting for workers' rights, fighting for a path to the middle class, for the working class, and making sure that we have jobs and economic security. And oftentimes I found when I knock on doors of folks who either grew up as Democrats and drifted away from the party, or who have no interest to begin with, they always associate us with our most extremes. And what I often have to tell them is you can't associate our party with what I call the performatively woke progressives who care more about tweeting than they care about legislating. And those folks can afford to do that because they're in New York or California or wherever else. They're in a D plus 1,000 seat where they're never going to lose re-election. I always look at the folks like my hero Congressman Kildee or Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, who's our neighboring congressional district. Look at the things that they're fighting for. They are still willing to call out institutional racism, combat sexism, and fight for LGBTQ rights at the same time that they're talking about those real kitchen table issues, whether it's investing in infrastructure, investing in education, creating good paying jobs. We can both call out those problems that have been with our country for centuries since its founding and try to win over those folks who want to make sure that they're going to have economic security, want to make sure that they have a path to the middle class. So I really think it's a false choice whether we go that route focusing on social issues or focusing on economic issues, because I think when we take that comprehensive approach, and really when the Democratic Party is at its best, is seeing that those kind of two sides that we bracket off are really linked and really one and the same.
I got to tell you, I was sitting here listening to you talking about a presidential candidate one day. Listening to the Rick Smith Show, we're here with Jasper Martis. Jasper's running for the new 69th Michigan State House District seat. You can check out his website at jaspermartis.com. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Really good stuff. Now, again, you focused on a whole bunch there. There's a lot to unpack. The big part of it is that division that the Democrats are saddled with. And I fear the Democrats don't fight back enough.
Yes.
And hard enough. You know, we were just talking with Senator Sherrod Brown and Senator Bob Casey, who are, in my view, two of the people who get the message the right way, talking about jobs, talking about kitchen table stuff, about health care. You know, that's where Democrats should be living. All of the other stuff, yeah, you be on the right side of history with, but that shouldn't be what defines you. I've always believed life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. You do your thing, but how do we make lives better? And that's where I'm thrilled to hear where your campaign is taking us and where I hope Democrats are going.
Well, and I think I am a huge fan of President Biden. I supported him in the primaries. I think he's been a transformative president. And the biggest critique I actually have of the Biden administration is they don't talk enough about the amazing things that they're accomplishing.
Right?
When you look at the ARPA package, when you look at the infrastructure package, when you look at the Inflation Reduction Act, this is I have two bumper stickers. I have the seal of Michigan, and I have all the way with LBJ bumper sticker. We've not seen this amount of investment in public works since the Great Society in the 1960s. And it may even rival in some ways the New Deal of the 30s and 40s. We're making such progressive strides. And yeah, until recently, a lot of folks just didn't want to talk about it. They were afraid to defend it. They were afraid that they were going to get attacked for it. And I have to say, I'm proud of being a member of a party and supporting a president who is able to accomplish all of these things. And I think that when we look back in history, 15, 20, 25 years down the line, we will talk about this ARPA package and infrastructure package the way that we talk about the Great Society. The problem is we just need to talk about it.
No, and we need to do more. And this is where, you know, I've been, you know, and the conversation I had with Senator Casey the other day, I said, look, you know, why aren't we seeing giant 15-foot statues of, you know, I did this. You know, remember those stupid things they were slapping on gas pumps?
Yeah,
saying,
I did that.
Joe,
yeah.
I did that. Why aren't we seeing giant 15-foot, you know, statues of Biden going, yeah, I did this.
Yeah.
As we're reinvesting in infrastructure, building manufacturing plants, as we're making lives better. You know, we went through 4 years of somebody taking credit for something that they didn't
yes,
do
yeah,
and weren't possibly able to do. The greatest promoter, the greatest, you know, carnival barker in the history of politics, taking credit for stuff that didn't even happen. And now you got a guy doing things and doing great things and, you know, just getting up, doing the work. Got to get that.
Yeah.
That message.
Yeah. And I'm a huge fan of the book series, The Years of Lyndon Johnson by Robert Carroll. I recommend it to anyone who's interested in politics. It's phenomenally written. And what's great about Caro when he talks about the legacy of Lyndon Johnson is he talks about not just the policies that Johnson pursued, but the people that were impacted by those policies. And he would take you through when Lyndon Johnson was a congressman, you know, people in his rural area of Hill Country, Texas, who for their entire lives had no access to electricity, even after most cities, especially in the north, had already been electrified. And Robert Caro takes you through what it was like to live without electricity, the painstaking effort of making a house work, making a family be able to survive without electricity, and then taking them through that electrification process. No, that's political power.
No, and this is where I get back to. You got to make lives better. Mm-hmm. And this is what Democrats forgot for a while.
Yeah.
They made the lives of some better. Mm-hmm. And this is where you talk to any working class person. Mm-hmm. You know, the Democrats are all about Wall Street, too. Mm-hmm. Democrats got to get back to making lives better. And I'm thrilled to hear the campaign that you're running. Again, I hope folks will check out the website, jaspermartis.com. Mm-hmm. We'll get links out on social media. I can check it out, maybe help out the campaign a little bit.
Appreciate that.
I know I'm going to be hearing a lot from you. I'd love to hear you talk to you again some point down the road.
Thank you so much, sir. Big fan of the show, big fan of the message that you're presenting, and please come back to Genesee County soon.
Oh, we've had such a great time here. Thanks so much, Jasper. Love to hear your thoughts as we spend some more time here at the Flint Farmers Market in Flint, Michigan. You can follow us along at thericksmithshow.com. We're trucking on down the road. Quick break right back here. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1845. That was the day that the first Industrial Congress of the United States met in New York City. People interested in the problems facing working people, including long hours, low pay, and unsafe working conditions, gathered together. The labor movement was just beginning in this country. These were the years when the early trade unions were formed. Women played an important role in the early labor movement. Female textile mill workers in Lawrence, Massachusetts began to organize for the 10-hour day. In 1844, they established the Lowell Female Labor Reform Association. Their goal was to improve working conditions in the mills. The Lowell Women's Group sent a representative to New York for the Labor Congress. Another important development of the fledgling labor movement was the establishment of labor presses. George Henry Evans, a labor newsman, also attended the Congress. He was the editor of a series of U.S. labor papers, starting with the Workman's Advocate in 1829. He had come to the United States from England, where he had been involved in the trade labor movement. He also attended the Labor Congress. The meeting recommended the formation of three organizations. First was an industrial brotherhood for workers, including farmers. The second was an industrial sisterhood for women workers. The third was a group for friends of labor. The Congress met again in New York in 1847, then again met in Chicago in 1850. These early efforts to establish larger labor groups did not gain much traction, but they began to lay the framework for workers to come together to discuss their challenges and imagine how they could work together to bring about change for better wages, shorter hours, and safer working conditions. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Hope you've been following along on the tour, and you can do that at thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the tour, podcast, obviously, where we've been, where we're going, all of that. Here in Flint, you know, I'll tell you, you know, talking with Jasper, his mother runs this facility, and fantastic place, but this kid's going to go places. As I said, you know, I think this kid is going to have a really, really bright future because he gets it. He gets the fact that, you know, we need to be investing in infrastructure. We need to be investing in manufacturing. We need to be pulling together workers and communities and people that no longer allow these divides to continue to rip us apart and define us. We need to be the ones moving forward and saying, look, we demand better opportunities. And I look at this, the organizing being done locally here to move in a direction that is positive. Everything that we've heard from all of the folks that we've talked to has been very positive, very, very forward looking. We're going to make things better. We're going to make things in this country. Imagine that. I mean, you know, for years we've been told, no, we don't need to make things. We'll just send it over and get cheap labor and we'll get cheap products. Well, you know what? It hasn't really worked out
hasn't worked out the way it was sold to us. And it never does work out the way they sell it to us. When the snake oil salesmen come around, it's never the miracle cure that they're pitching. It's always, well, you're getting cheated, I'm getting cheated. And at the end of the day, they're the ones walking off with the gold and treasure. Now is the time. Now is the time for us to stand up, stick together, and fight for the policies that I think are going to help move us in the right direction. And, you know, someone like Jasper, he gets it. Good on him. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Also, follow us along, ricksmithshow.com, podcast, all of that.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1899. That was the day union miners in Mount Olive, Illinois, began commemorating Miners' Day. Every year, thousands came into town for a parade, music, and speeches. Mount Olive was the site of the only union-owned cemetery in the United States, established by UMWA Local 728 in the aftermath of the Verdun Massacre. A year before to the day, striking miners had been killed in a shootout with company goons attempting to herd scabs into the mines in Verdun, Illinois. But, as Mother Jones biographer Elliot Gorn notes, the train never unloaded its cargo and the company was forced to settle. The union hoped to erect a gravesite monument commemorating those miners who had been killed at Verdun, but they were refused by those who considered the fallen miners to be murderers and not martyrs. That's when the United Mine Workers established the Union Miners Cemetery. And on this day, 10,000 turned out for the union's memorial ceremony. The United Mine Workers unveiled a monument dedicated to the fallen Verdun miners E.W. Smith, Joe Gitterly, Ernest Kramer, and E.F. Long. The day was filled with parades, music, laying of wreaths, and speeches. Haymarket widow and radical activist Lucy Parsons was among the speakers. In his book, Death and Dying in the Working Class, Michael Rosnow notes that her presence drew a direct connection between the fallen miners and the Haymarket martyrs, cut down while advancing the cause of labor. Thousands traveled to Mount Olive every year for celebrations, including Eugene V. Debs, miners' leader John Mitchell, and Mother Jones. In 1923, Mother Jones asked to be buried with her boys, noting they are responsible for Illinois being the best organized labor state in America. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
The problem with our so-called free market is that it's not free for you and me. It's largely controlled by monopolies, which are free to inflate prices just because they can, letting gougers gleefully extract unwarranted monopoly profits from us. This milking of consumers by tightly consolidated industries is propelling today's surging price hikes. Brand name corporations claim they're being forced to mark up price tags just to cover rising costs for raw materials, labor, transportation, etc. But in a competitive marketplace, they'd have to eat much of those increases by taking a bit less in profits. Indeed, monopolies are now raising prices simply to squeeze even greater profits from hard-hit consumers, a game of corporate greed that socks America with more inflation. Consider diapers. A year ago, Procter & Gamble announced that the pandemic was driving up its production costs, forcing it to raise prices for its Pampers brand. At the time, it had just posted a quarterly profit of $3.8 billion, so P&G could easily have absorbed a temporary rise in its costs. But instead of holding the price to ease their customers' economic pain, the conglomerate used a global health crisis to justify upping diaper prices. 6 months later, P&G's quarterly profit topped $5 billion. And in that same quarter, P&G spent $3 billion to buy back shares of its own stock, a Wall Street manipulation that artificially bloats the wealth of top executives and other big shareholders. In short, P&G used the excuse of inflation to inflate the price of their diapers, then use the extra money it extracted to inflate the value of its stock to benefit rich shareholders. This is Jim Hightower saying, well, couldn't consumers just switch to Huggies, the brand sold by P&G's main competitor? No, for it's a co-monopolist, having also goosed up its prices.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So had an incredible opportunity to go and visit the Gerald Ford Presidential Library. Anybody who knows me, who's listened to this program, knows that anytime there's a presidential library nearby, I'm going to stop. I've been fortunate. I've gone and seen the Carter one, the W one, Eisenhower, Truman. We were just over the summer, we were at JFK's. And now I had the chance to spend a couple of hours at the Gerald Ford Presidential Library. And I got to tell you, I really, out of all of them, this is the one that surprised me the most. And I'm not quite sure why, but it was really well done. And even though Betsy DeVos's name is on the front of it, and we'll get into why I'm disturbed by that, I really enjoyed my time there, and I was hoping to get somebody to sit down with us last minute, you know, racing through this stuff. We will, though, in the future. But here to share some thoughts on the time we spent at the Gerald Ford Presidential Museum, our good friend, the producer, the professor, Brett. How we doing, man?
We're doing great.
So, initial thoughts?
Well, actually, this was a first for me. I've never been to a presidential library before. So while I don't have anything to compare it to, you know, I was pretty impressed by what I saw.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I liked the fact that it was chronological. You walked in, it started, you know, birth, and went through and progressed, because his main, you know, the thing of his presidency was integrity. The thing of his presidency was bringing some bit of, well, not criming back to the office. So building on a childhood and building, you know, this character, this integrity, this compassion, you know, all of those things that, you know, buzzwords that politicians love to throw around, that I get that that's how they, why they did what they did and how they built this museum around those core things.
Yeah, I think that seemed that was the kind of the core concept of the place, and what they built it around was that, you know, Gerald Ford was just a kind of a model of decency, and not only a model of decency, but a model of decency at a time in our country's history when we really needed it.
Yeah, and now the thing is, you can't talk about Gerald Ford regardless of what position or what side, because I'll tell you, I'm jaded. I walked in there expecting to not like it, to critique everything, to tear everything apart. But the one thing you can say is that he made a tough choice at a tough time. He chose to pardon Richard Nixon, which they were front and center on.
Yeah, I mean, that was something a decision I believe he made very quickly.
First month.
After becoming president. And the goal was to, you know, create some kind of national healing. Now, there were also, you know, things that I learned about him that I actually didn't know. You know, for example, there wasn't just one attempt on his life. There were two. Now, both unsuccessful, of course. But I wasn't even, it was a part of history that just was never really taught, you know. And, you know, so this idea that he was there to kind of, you know, heal the nation, you know, the nation, you know, showed a lot of signs it didn't want to heal.
Yeah, well, and two women at that. I mean, that's the other part of it. And like I told you as we were looking at it, I remember Squeaky Fromm from the Manson family. I didn't remember Sarah Jane, and I'm not sure why. I'm not sure if it's because it's, you know, she was, you know, Squeaky was part of the Manson family or what, or if history just tried to forget both women who tried this. I'm not sure, but yep, I remember that moment.
Right. I think it might have something to do with the fact that, you know, one made an attempt but didn't get very far into it. She never was really able to, you know, to get a shot off. You know what I mean? Where the other one did. You know, I guess she narrowly missed him. And so there was probably why that got a little more attention.
Well, wasn't it? I think it was Squeaky Fromm who didn't get it off, right?
To be honest, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think that's how it worked. The one who got the shot off actually didn't get remembered, which I guess, again, kind of an interesting bit of time. But, you know, in talking about that, you know, the pardon of Nixon, wildly unpopular at the time. Another thing that came out that I didn't know is when he became president, and I guess it just shows what kind of a different country we were then. He had a 71% approval rating you know, the day he took office, people were like, okay, we're going to give him a chance. We're going to do all this. When he pardons Nixon, his approval rating goes down to 50%. You could argue that if he were in it for pure politics, and there's a bunch of arguments that, you know, he was set in that position to do this specifically, and maybe he was, but he took a major hit. I don't think, and you could disagree with me, I don't think if he chooses not to pardon Nixon, makes him go through and sweat and do all that stuff, I think he gets reelected.
Oh, I think he probably
does. Or he
gets
elected. Let's go.
Right, right. No, I think that's probably the way that works out as well. I mean, he knew the penalty for the thing that he was about to do, and, you know, and he did it anyway, knowing that he was going to pay that price, which, you know, eventually he did. He was beaten by Jimmy Carter in the next election. But again, he did it anyway. And at no time that I recall did he ever express any regret over doing it. And again, this is, you know, draws some pretty, you know, significant parallels to what's going on today.
No, I mean, it was a tumultuous time in our country at the time, at the ending of the Vietnam War. The economy was horrible. During his tenure, there was a graph on the wall that showed, you know, how inflation just massively spiked during the middle of his presidency, and how, you know, by the end of it, it had come somewhat down. Unemployment had come back down as well, but, you know, the massive inflation during his presidency, and we don't really think about that in those terms of his administration.
No, we really don't. I mean, well,
when we settled Carter with that.
Yeah. Well, when he did something as monumental as pardoning Nixon, that became the thing, you know, that he was known for. He was kind of typecast for that, you know, for kind of the rest of his political career. And it kind of makes sense because it was such a monumental thing. And a lot of different presidents have a one key moment that ends up defining their presidency. And Gerald Ford's came, you know, a month in, and, you know, and there was really no recovering, or no, there's no changing that narrative after that happened.
No, I, you know, in looking at some of the displays, and you know, we'll get pictures out and share some of the thoughts. You know, you knew he was a Republican, though, because of some of the policy decisions and some of the things that he pushed for. You know, deregulation was really kind of birthed during this era, where, you know, and they even had a quote from Jimmy Carter. They're going, you know, we were all in agreement. There was almost no disagreement in policy between his administration and Carter's administration, which was weird to say.
Right. And even when you talk about some of the most partisan folks out there, it's very, you don't see anyone really say a bad word about Ford or really criticize his policies or his decisions. It's pretty much kind of almost a universal opinion that, you know, that he mostly got it right.
Now, you got to wonder in today, you know, because they did focus on integrity. They did focus on his faith. They did focus on this personal courage. They did focus on all of these things that I don't doubt. I've never had anything but respect for Gerald Ford. Where would he come down in an era like today? You know, where would he fit in today's Republican Party?
No, I don't think there's any room for him in today's Republican Party. But there's no room for Republicans in today's Republican Party. I mean, the policies have gone so far off the deep end. I mean, we've gone from right to far right to out of this world right. I mean, these guys are about to fall off the edge of the flat earth at some point. It's really gotten crazy. I think Gerald Ford would be right there with some of the other ex-presidents and, you know, other Republicans and long-standing Republicans who can't help but just kind of look at the ground and shake their head.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting to me, again, I come back to this moment where you think about the party, the Republican Party of old and where we are today. You know, one of the things that he had proposed back then was like a 5% surcharge, a tax on people making, you know, middle income. And they highlighted this in the displays that, you know, people wrote to him and said, hey, this is going to crush us. An additional tax on working people is going to crush us. And it was interesting to me as I was, you know, thinking about and reading through what they had displayed, that his first thought was, we're going to raise taxes on working people and not the very wealthy. That grabbed me. But the other thing is, and they didn't talk about this at all that I could find in the museum, that Ford was one of the first in modern era to give a tax rebate, to go, you know, we're going to give you a check, you know, much like we got during the pandemic. In fact, you know, he sent back $200 to people making $20,000 a year or less. And if you made, you know, $30,000 or less, you got, I think it was $100. And then, you know, obviously nothing above that. But nowhere in there did they have that displayed. And I thought that was something that should have been. Now, what did we learn from that? We learned that, you know, it didn't spur economic growth. People didn't spend it the way they intended. There was a lesson that was learned, but it did help working people because you know what they did with it? They saved it. Kind of like we saw coming out of the pandemic, which is why savings has kind of boosted as we're coming out of the pandemic.
Right. And while this the most recent stimulus checks that were sent out during the pandemic, what we found in those is that the people did use those. They did pump them right back into the economy, mostly because they had to, because, you know, people were in pretty desperate situation during that time. But the idea that when Gerald Ford did it, that it wasn't used in the same way, that it was saved more often by people, kind of tells you a little bit about the state of affairs and the working class between then and now. There's a lot more desperation in today's economy than there was in that economy. So an economic stimulus plan that he put in place then wasn't used the same way it was used now, because, you know, people needed that money and they needed it right now and they needed to spend it on, you know, on food, groceries, you know, gas and all these different items. So this time when we did it, you know, it worked out a little differently.
Now, you're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm here with Brett Pransky, the professor, my producer, my mate here on the Working Class Heroes Radio Tour. You can follow us along wherever we go, where we've been, where we're going. Just go to TheRickSmithShow.com. Of course, if you miss any portion of the tour, grab the podcast. Never miss an episode. Talking about the Gerald Ford Presidential Museum in Grand Rapids, and really a beautiful place. But I got to tell you, Brett, little offsetting. As you pull into this beautiful facility, the first thing you see is the DeVos name. And I got to know, and this was one of the things that I hope, if we get someone to come talk with us from the museum, how much it costs to get on that building. Because when we did the George W. Bush Museum and Presidential Library down in Dallas, it cost $1,000 to get on the digital registry. They wouldn't tell us how much it was to get your name etched in granite on the wall. But I got to know, you know, on the whole marquee of the DeVos name, I got to know how much went into that.
Well, I'm sure it was a substantial amount of money. I mean, if they wouldn't even tell you what it costs to get your name in the granite wall at the Bush Library, it means because they know you can't afford it.
No, of course I can't afford it. I can't afford the $1,000 for the digital one.
Right. So in the DeVos, it was the DeVos Learning Center, which I found highly, highly ironic. I think the first thing they teach you is what an oxymoron is. But it, yeah, it, you know that they must have just spent absolute boatloads of money to get that. And there was an actual DeVos Learning Center inside, which, you know, oddly enough, was
dark,
was empty and unlit, which, you know, metaphorically speaking, is about perfect. But yeah, I mean, it was a little striking to see that in big, bold blue letters outside the front of the building.
Yeah, you know what I found most interesting of the whole time there? It's just one of those weird kind of, it really grabbed my attention kind of. We were leaving, we go to the gift shop, and I wanted to buy a bobblehead doll because I collect little goofy things, and I wanted an FDR one. It turns out the Roosevelts are the most popular selling things there in the Ford Museum. They had plenty of Gerald Fords, no Roosevelts.
Right, and you know, I made a joke, and the folks that are not supposed to be partisan, they're not supposed to let out a lean, but I will say that they laughed when I said that the price of the Trump statue was that, you know, they give it to us for free and pay us $20 to take it with us.
Yeah. Now the interesting thing is when they opened up the cabinet, plenty of Trump ones. And I guess, and there's part of me that goes, if you're attracted to going to see someone like Gerald Ford, to see his presidential museum, probably not a Trump supporter.
Most likely not. I mean, Gerald Ford would be labeled a rhino about a tenth of a second after he walked in the room. So, you know, I imagine this wasn't something that was real popular among the Trump supporters.
Now we walk in, and you know, one of the first things we did see was a piece of the Berlin Wall, which, you know, you don't think about, you know, Ford being part of that, but his career, his legacy, you know, 25 years in Congress, being pulled to be the vice president in a very, very uneasy time. He saw a lot. And then, you know, he talked about his military career. I mean, this guy led an incredible life of service to this country. And whether you agree with him or not, and I don't agree with most of his policies, I do respect him.
Yeah. And to be honest, I think it was a good time to go to the Gerald Ford Museum and to see kind of what common decency, especially common decency among what we would call our patriotic opposition, what it looks like. You know, and to see someone just focus on doing what he thought was best for the American people. Again, like you said, a lot of these things we would not agree with, you know, in terms of policy and things like that. But nothing in there that would give me the sense that this was someone who was hyper partisan or, you know, who put, you know, politics over what was good for the American people. He just simply tried to do what he thought he was right, what he thought was right. And, you know, while we didn't always and probably wouldn't, you know, always agree with everything that he did, no doubt of his convictions or his motivations.
Now, we walk into the place, though, and Brett almost has a heart attack because there is a giant statue of a Michigan football player because evidently he was, you know, he was a heck of a football player, got offers from the Packers and the Lions, was like good for the day.
Yeah, apparently he was a bit of a guy. You know what I mean? I hope they lost to Ohio State every year that he was at Michigan. But other than that, you know what I mean? Other than that, he seemed like a pretty decent guy.
No, but it's a beautiful facility, and I hope people will check it out if you're ever in Grand Rapids. Well worth the couple of hours that we spent there. And would again, it's another one of those places I'd like to go back again because we actually went through it twice. Simply because, you know, when you go through things, you catch your eye here on one thing and you might miss something else. There were tons of, you know, videos. In fact, the second time we went through, we got to see the video of his time, you know, in the Navy with the attack and all of the stories that went there that we missed the first time around.
Right. I guess there was an event on his first tour where they weren't attacked, but they were hit by a typhoon.
Typhoon, yeah.
And what had happened was it rocked the boat and, you know, some of the planes, because he served on a carrier, some of the planes snapped free of their moorings and ran into each other. There were sparks. There was a fire. You know, there were several deaths. And it actually...
Not several. In fact, you know, they said, you know, there were so many deaths from that typhoon of people drowning more than that, the Battle of Midway. Right. I never knew that.
No, I never knew that either. I think there were like three or four deaths on his ship, but it actually sank. I can't remember two or three other ships in the fleet, and there were something like 700-800 dead.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's these are the kind of things that we should be teaching in school.
Precisely.
I was never a Gerald Ford fan, still not a huge fan, but I respect what he did. I respect the time when he was in office, and the person that he was. I don't know that we have that politic today.
No, we really don't. I mean, but again, you know, one of the things that we keep discovering over and over again on this tour is that people have an appetite for that. If we can return to that style of politics, there are people out there who will respond to it.
Amen.
And so, you know, it's just something that we need to work a little harder at.
Yeah, good stuff. But again, if you're ever in Grand Rapids, stop at the Gerald Ford Museum. Well worth the time and well worth the... you know, the effort. I suggested. Any final thoughts on the museum?
No, I think if it's going to be my first one, I think this was a great one to kick it off.
Most certainly a good one. I want to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show. We're taking a break during the holiday season, wishing you and yours the very best holiday ever. Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at therickSmithShow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com, as we wrap up our time in Flint. One of the things that grabs my attention, and I keep coming back to this because I think it's so important. Everyone that we've met, everyone that we've talked to, from the people who showed us around the city to the transport that got us back and forth from the hotel to the farmer's market, all the people who are so gracious with their time and shared their stories. The one thing that keeps coming back to me is that I think we all want the same things. We want to be able to lead safe lives, prosperous lives. We want good schools. We want safe neighborhoods. We want a future. We want opportunities. And again, Flint, to me, is one of those places that we're told is the worst of the worst, the bottom of the economic scale, a city in turmoil, a city in decline, all of that. And yet what we found here was, you know, hardworking people wanting better lives, hardworking people who are looking to the future positively. And this is why I'm so excited about this moment, because what the right keeps telling us is that the country's on fire, that, you know, everything's horrible, that is rampant crime everywhere, a violent crime, that around every corner is a boogeyman. And yet I come to a place like Flint and we're greeted with open arms. We're greeted by people who want to share their city and their experience and their hopes and their dreams and their wants, want to share the possibilities of the future. And this is why, again, I keep coming back to, in an election cycle like this, one of the things that we should be really focusing on is making sure that we don't lose sight of the fact that we are moving in a good direction. Finally, there's someone in the White House who can say union without choking, that's pushing for workers to share in the prosperity of their labor, that's wanting to rebuild our country and the power that we once had as working people. The idea that we should have manufacturing, we should be reshoring and rebuilding and revitalizing our productive capacity. You know, my mind always goes back to that bridge in New Jersey, Trenton makes, the world takes. We can be that country again, but more importantly, we can be the country that says, you know what, the shirt I bought or the shoes I wear or the car I drive or the TV I'm watching or the smartphone I'm spending all of my time on, that was made by my friends and neighbors. It was made by me. It was made here by us. This kind of idea of, you know, domestic production for domestic consumption. And I think coming out of the pandemic, I think we've come to the reality that you have to produce things. And we've got a president who's moving us in that direction. I wish I could say that about the Republican Party in this moment. I wish I could say that there were somebody there who was leading this charge to say, yeah, we want to build good, strong union jobs. We want to build a prosperous economy for working people. And yet I go back to the former administration where they talked a good game, and I was with them. Man, I was on board. I wanted them to succeed in recreating that prosperous working class and reshoring manufacturing and investing in infrastructure. They talked it constantly. It's all you heard. In fact, it was always infrastructure week, and yet got nothing done. What was their major accomplishment? Tax cuts for the rich. That's the reality. So all of the rhetoric aside, all of the verbiage aside, comes down to what you did, what you're doing. And what they did was they gave more to the people who already have more. And nothing more, nothing else. What this administration is doing, they're not out there saying how wonderful they are. They're not tooting their own horn. I think they should be. Again, 15-foot Biden statues everywhere going, I did this. But they're doing the work, passing the policy, without any help from the other side, from the Republican aisle. It's time to start holding people accountable. And Republicans, bring your party back to the same line. Bring them back. I would love to see a Republican Party who cares about working people. I just don't right now. Because for me, this isn't about which hat you're wearing.
and it shouldn't be. For us in the working class, there's more that unites us than divides us, which is why the wealth class of this country has to find all those little fissures, all those little things to divide and tear us apart. It's our job, it's our responsibility to set that aside and move forward and say, you know what? We demand better, not just for ourselves, but for our children and for future generations. We demand an America, a prosperous America for working people. That's not too hard to ask, is it? Has been thus far.
You're listening to The Shaw. WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.